Welcome to Idle Redheads, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Redheads. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. So some of the gaming news that we're excited about is Valiant and Catalyst announcement that they will be producing a comic book-based game or games. So the Valiant universe, for people who don't know, started around late 80s, early 90s, and had such characters as Exo Man of War, Shadow Man, Ray, and Turok.
That's the only one I knew.
Turok?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a former Gold Key character, so he's been around since the 50s. So they had at least two Gold Key characters, him and Solar. Yeah, but it looks like they're using it for the Q system, which is the one used for Cosmic Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the thing that really hooked my attention since, as everybody knows, I'm a massive comic book guy, not. So I was more interested in, to see, oh, and they're going to be using the same system that Cosmic Patrol did. And I wonder how they're going to do that. Because Cosmic Patrol was a lot of fun. It is definitely not a mechanics-heavy system. So, I don't know. I'm curious how they're going to do superheroes in it.
That sounds actually, though, that it might work in their favor, because superheroes, they have such a wide berth of powers and actually depth for that matter, people who are extremely powerful versus ones that aren't very powerful. So a rules light system would probably work in their favor, at least in that sense.
In a sense, definitely. And it's kind of the same thing when we looked at Marvel. The first time we opened up that Cortex Plus heroic thing, I think all of us said, that is not the system I expected to see in this mm-hmm. book for superheroes. But it does work really well. Those, power set dice buckets allow you to mimic the powers of the characters you're playing quite well, more so if you know the character.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking about Cosmic Patrol, unless they add mechanics, you pretty much only have those six stats, like right. brains, brawn, charisma, combat, special, and then if they keep that luck number,
mm-hmm.
And everything else was kind of non-mechanical aspects,
right.
just, kind of catchphrases and cues, so I can see why they call it the cue system. And while that would be really open, and, I could see the system saying, this die represents whatever superpower you have, and whatever you can narrate that character doing, the rules cover, because it is so open.
Right.
I mean, that's even less mechanical than Cortex Plus Heroic. So I could see some people really not liking that because they would want a bit more mechanics supporting their superpower ability.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's no mechanical individuality to a player. There's no special power or special rule, for example, for a flight ability. It's just kind of, here's a dice for speed, and it can be flight if you want it to be.
Right.
Right. Do you need that?
No, not at all. I mean, of course.
Like, if you say, I can fly, great.
Hmm.
Like, how many races do you have with flying characters?
Well, yeah, like, I totally agree. I don't think there's any necessity for there to be those mechanics, but I think Wayne's right that some people might balk at there not being any.
Right.
One thing about Valiant, and certainly having to think back years, that they did is they really tried to, at least when Jim Shooter was running the show, I believe one of the things that he really was trying to push is that it is a really integrated world, and you're not going to have necessarily continuity problems.
Mm-hmm.
So very much about the story. And then I believe every year they would have a big crossover event.
Okay.
But they really try to contain the story where, one part of the comic book universe would go off in this completely different direction. And you're like, well, if there's an alien invasion there, why aren't the Avengers there?
Mm-hmm.
Right,
kind of thing. So definitely emphasizing story. So I guess using something that's a very narrative system is very much in keeping with the game. I think it's also just in keeping with the way people are starting to play now. They just don't have time to learn a lot of rules.
Right,
agreed.
And it helps them differentiate themselves from Mutants and Masterminds, which is much more mechanical.
That's kind of like a D20 thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really, apart from Cortex, all the superhero systems that I know are extremely mechanical. I mean, Hero, jeez.
I'm just excited to see something using the queue system.
Yeah, that was, I think that was probably the most fun I've ever had in a little single pickup game. I absolutely loved it.
So, I'm excited. In case you couldn't tell by my monotone voice.
I'm excited.
No, obviously I would be more excited if I knew more about the Valiant comic universe. So, or more disappointed because I may have thought it stunk. But
well,
that's some optimism for you.
Yeah, you're the optimistic one here, not me.
So today's episode is crap movies that we think would make great games. We had a selection process, and we have some rules for the episode. Rule number one is that the person suggesting the movie actually has to think it's a bad movie. They can't suggest a guilty pleasure or a cult classic. And one of the reasons for this is that we're going to be relaxing our no spoiler policy. So we're actually saying these are bad movies and you should not watch these as movies because they are bad. You should only watch this in order to get game ideas. So we have no problems with spoiling the entire plot. Rule number two is this movie should be universally considered a bad movie, or at least the vast majority of people. So what we've done is we've used Rotten Tomatoes Tomato Meter, and each movie has to rate 30% or less in order to be considered a crap movie. Number three, of course, is that we should think that there are good game ideas in which you can mine, because there'd be no point to the episode. Number four. We're not going to be choosing movies that are based on games, because that's just kind of cheating. So if you take the Dungeons & Dragons game and then the movie, hey, this would make a great fantasy game. Oh. Or Resident Evil, I think it would make a great role-playing game that deals with survival horror. Yeah. So we've eliminated those movies out there. So that, I think that takes out of all of Uwe Boll's filmography.
So what kind of Street Fighter or Mortal Kombat too?
Got to change my list.
I know. Because, you know, fighting games turned into movies make such terrible movies that you're just like, yeah.
But we have the rest of Jean-Claude Van Damme's filmography to work
with. Very true.
So again, we are relaxing the no spoiler policy. So if we, when we introduce the movie and you think you might want to watch it and enjoy it, haha, for its cinematic value, please skip that part. But of course, if you're fine with us spoiling the entire movie for you, then listen away. And we still think you could actually go back and watch the movie, but from the perspective of, hey, let's see if I can pull these elements that they were talking about and use them in a game.
Cool.
So the inspiration actually was the movie Johnny Mnemonic, with a Rotten Tomatoes score of 14%.
Ouch.
No.
I've seen worse, but that's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is a little harsh. But even though this is my suggestion, Johnny Mnemonic and the inspiration, and I watched this, and for people that don't know Johnny Mnemonic, it is the idea, it is in the future, near future, and the lead character, Johnny, Keanu Reeves, plays a data courier. So in order to safely transport information, you put it into the brain of these couriers, and they will physically take it to the location. And there are some safeguards that they have in order to protect the data.
Right. The courier also doesn't know what the data is. It's kind of like a double blind.
Mm. Yep. And the safeguards not only protect the data from other people, but also protects the data from the courier.
Right.
From them to know it. It's set in Newark and Beijing. And the movie came out in the mid-90s. And this is a time when the internet was, you know, started to become somewhat popular. So, of course, it incorporates a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And people might have
a real nice view of the future with the internet and fax machines and VCRs.
Right. I love that one scene where he's like, get your VCRs ready to record this download. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? The movie did not age well, I'll say that.
And that's fine. I think why it's a bad movie is that it's kind of boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just watched this movie the first time like 2 weeks ago. I thought I finally should get around to watching this Johnny Mnemonic.
Finally watched it today.
Yeah.
I think I watched it in like 96.
and you let a lot go, you know, okay, the internet does not look like that now. That looks really primitive. But I just lost interest about halfway through the movie.
That's a lot later than I did.
And sorry. I wanted to maintain interest because I was seeing elements that I thought would be good for a game, but also, I couldn't figure out if the director realized he was making a bad movie and just phoning it in.
Right.
Or if this the director was trying to do something and it just wasn't working.
Right.
It was none of the above, by the way.
Yes, so Chris actually knows the backstory about what happened.
Yeah, actually, I admit this is a no, it's not a favorite. This is I like this movie, actually quite a bit. But it turns out that the director Robert Longo, this was his first like big time feature film, and he had some connection with William Gibson. I'm not sure if they're friends or if they'd worked together on something else. But William Gibson, you know, who created the cyberpunk genre. He, this was his, first adaptation of, one of his books into a screenplay, or actually several of his books into a screenplay. And I guess from what I heard is that they attempted to do something really tongue in cheek that was kind of playing off of the, you know, the cheap over the top action and, thriller movies that were going on in the 90s. And, so that's the movie that they tried to make. But when they showed it to the studio before release, the studio was horrified because they actually wanted, you know, like a cheap, incongruent action-esque kind of movie. So they used their final cut powers to completely recut the movie into something that would be more action-oriented. And I think because of that, it was made as something of a comedy or a parody, but that tried to be recut into an action. I think it lost a lot of itself in that transition. So, but I really like it for a lot of the features, and I think the different settings, both the internet and the virtual world that they portray the internet as, and also kind of the dystopian world that they show the real world to be, I think it's really well made.
Yeah, but I was wondering about that because the acting is not good. And you're watching Dolph Lundgren, but I'm not, you know, I don't hate Dolph Lundgren. The man's pretty accomplished.
Yeah, I read that was Dolph Lundgren's last appearance on film until The Expendables.
What? No, he made a lot of straight-to-DVD movies.
Oh, okay. Maybe it was
John Woo for quite a while.
Okay.
And he's playing a preacher, like a cybernetic preacher assassin.
Right.
And you're like, am I supposed to take this character seriously?
Right.
And they even do a commentary on him. Like, they have Ice-T doing a commentary on the guy. They're like watching him, and you're like, okay. Doesn't seem like they're taking him that seriously.
Right.
Even though he's supposed to be this uber assassin. And then Keanu Reeves, who is good in some movies, and then not good in others. And you're like, but I wasn't sure. Like, I think he's going for something here. I think he's trying to play this guy as really flat.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was working because he was like really flat. But you're like, is it bad acting or is it? I mean, if he saw the dailies, he's like, that's it, hit it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I just couldn't do it. So yeah, that answers a lot. Maybe it was, you know, something that was badly cut. It was cut, and it is bad.
Well, supposedly, if you're interested in seeing the actual director's cut the way it was planned to be, there's only one place in the world you can get it, and that's in Japan. The Japanese release was the director's cut.
Interesting.
Oh, then I've seen it.
You saw the director's cut? You just saw the Japanese version?
I saw the Japanese Johnny Mnemonic.
Did you... Did it have only Japanese subtitles, as in you couldn't understand what Takeshi Kitano was saying?
Yep.
Oh, then you have seen the Japanese, the director's cut.
Oh, interesting.
All right, so it isn't the cut.
Oh,
it's just a bad movie.
It's just a bad movie in general. Anyway, so why do you think this would make a good game? Because we've bagged this enough.
Right. I think it would make a good game because it's a really accessible cyberpunk universe.
Okay.
You have... The corporations are bad. Then you have, you know, everything's, you know, it's dystopian. Mm-hmm. Got it. Then you have low techs. Like, you have a very obvious antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain things, like, I thought they did a good job with, like, quality cybernetics versus cheap cybernetics and what it could do. Like, how the bad things, like, you get the shakes.
Yeah, the black shakes, NAS.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They turn black. If you notice, the nobules would be black.
I didn't notice that.
Versus like silver.
Okay.
So I mean, that was good. I mean, they did have that thing that was wrong with their brain, which they did have to explain with some opening script at the beginning of the opening text at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
That was good. I mean, there's an overall, like, the whole world is going to be suffering from these cybernetic effects.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So good. It's kind of like if you have hero characters, there's certainly something for them to do.
You have your creeping conflict, yeah.
Yeah. You have the underground, which the Henry Rollins was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that as well. So, it was very easy to get a grip on what this universe is. And then you have these data couriers, so a very interesting central character to have, or especially for like a one-on-one session.
Right. A great plot device, you know. You can have that kind of thing installed against somebody's will, and suddenly everybody's after them because something he can't control.
Right. And it takes away their memories, and they lose their memories. So he had, in order to create sort of storage space in his head, he had to give away his childhood.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that was good, but you do get bits and pieces. And then one of the things he wanted to do is pay for the restoration of these childhood memories.
Right, right.
So you can have the eternal thing. Then you had the bodyguard character that he meets up with, who bought the cheap cybernetics, and she's actually faster and stronger than those with the quality cybernetics, but she shakes and she's going to have some problems. She was even blacking out. So, yeah, it was like you could definitely see, you know, if a system has advantages and disadvantages. And buying those, you can see that it plays up like the juicers and riffs.
Right.
It was good. So the mega corporations with the Japanese, they really played up the Japanese angle. And I have said before that I like it when we see Japan through a Western prism because they try to pluck out what they think is cool.
Right. In this case, katanas and Yakuza tattoos.
Right.
Laser whips. Like,
yeah.
And monofilament thumb wires. But no, those are all good points. Yeah, everything is pretty clear. It's very straightforward. It's not noir because there actually aren't really all that many twists. Like the people you expect to be bad are bad, and the people you expect to be good are good. Mm-hmm. So I could see it being a seed for a plot for a game. As you said, Lyle, maybe one-on-one or maybe like two-player characters, because the thing about, you know, playing a role-playing game is you're going to have multiple player characters. So I don't really know who, if you had more than two player characters, I don't really know who the third one would be.
CyberDoc. Henry Rollins.
CyberDoc. You had Udo, your fixer.
Yeah, but would you really bring the fixer along on the kind of adventure, though?
Not necessarily, but I mean, like in the Cyberpunk 2020 RPG, which I loved when I was younger. Fixer was a regular character class, you know, just.
But Johnny was actually a better hacker than a data courier had to be.
Right.
He was actually just really good at that. So you could have taken that skill set out of him.
Okay.
Yeah, and given it to the hacker, which they tried to incorporate. I liked how they had to bring those like big gadget stuff around. So it was a little bit bulky. So it definitely was like a retro, from our perspective, and a retro cyberpunk, which is like their information tech is bulkier than what we have, even though they're in the future.
Right.
But that gives it a certain charm. And you can play it. I mean, there's different things that we could have done. We could have done the selfish, like, data courier angle, or the Keanu Reeves, where he collects the party, in a sense.
Mm.
But it's pretty much we were stumbling, we're doing good in spite of ourselves. But they really just wanted to do selfish things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, or you could have done it to the underground that are fighting this nerve attenuation syndrome.
Right.
Or you could do it from the low techs that are just, although they work with the underground, but you could have just done a pure low tech. You hate high technology, so you're just going to be against that.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, like it's kind of like you're fighting against, high technology, and hey, here's a solution to fix everybody of NAS. So why wouldn't you go for that? Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
So that's why I thought that would be a good game. And of course, you could use any cyber tech. Cyberpunk system out there, or things that allow for that, or just the universal system such as GURPS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and GURPS has some pretty good cyberpunk supplements.
Yeah.
Or cyber supplements, maybe not cyberpunk specifically, but yeah.
No, they have that, and they have biotech. So, I mean, you can even change that. I mean, it could be
less
of the it could be biotech.
I mean, heck, you could even do it in a fantasy setting with magic.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Where they have this, I mean, that character, the data courier, it can sound a little bit boring. You just put data in his head and he or she walks from point A to point B. Mm. But because it's such a dangerous thing, they are, in a sense, a secret agent. Like they have that jack of all trades skill set.
Yeah, they have to make it. That opens up a lot of possibilities to different types of courier characters, because you have to make it from point A to point B, and maybe you do that because you're really skilled and can take care of yourself, kind of like Keanu Reeves and Jenny Mnemonic, or maybe it's because you have a lot of money and are hiring people to protect you and keep you safe. So
a lot of allies,
You could throw all kinds of different factors on top of it to ratchet up the tension, like you can't take too much damage or else it might, you know, shock your system and hurt the data in your head, or maybe you can only keep it in there for a limited amount of time before it starts to kill you. What was it? What did they call it? Information seep or something?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you could do a lot of things to ratchet up the tension while you're on a job, as it were.
I would play that game.
Yeah. What was your crap movie, Chris?
Mine, I don't think there's going to be any debate on it being crap or not. The first one was Lady in the Water, which was M. Night Shyamalan movie.
And the Rotten Tomatoes rating?
Something like 4%.
Sorry. Gosh, it should be.
Let me pull it up here. 24%. That's way too high.
You're looking at the critics part, right?
That's the critics part too. Yeah, the audience is 49%.
Well, why did you think it was such a crap movie?
Well, okay, actually, I want to kind of soften it at first that I didn't hate it. It was one of those, when it finished, I was sad because I thought that it had a lot of potential, but it was ruined by M. Night Shyamalan. His acting and his ego, and there's some other pretty bad parts of it as well. But yeah, it was the crap part of it was that M. Night Shyamalan has a bad habit of putting himself in all of his movies, despite him being unable to really act that well. And in this one, he gave himself a central role where he cast himself as a screenwriter who's going to save the entire world through his writings, which, yeah, good for you, M. Night. There were some questionable, acting choices as well. Some of the other actors didn't really carry the plot. But that said, the primary guy, Paul Giamatti, he was amazing in it. I think he did, he made, all of the good parts of the movie, by himself. And, yeah. So the basic premise of it is that there's a lady who comes out of a pool. She's kind of based off of, like a water nymph, idea out of Greek mythology, but also kind of also touches on like a muse in that she inspires people to be better than they are. The name that he chose for these creatures were called Narfs, which this is the only time in the episode I'm going to say because it's the stupidest name I've ever heard.
Narf, as in N-A-R-F?
Correct, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what I thought of that one. Did you guys see it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
How much did you hate it?
More than you, even though you recommended it. I the premise, the saving humanity, it's a fairy tale, something that M. Night Shyamalan told us kids.
Yeah, he wrote his own fairy tale book and then also turned it into a movie.
Right, and they're all supposed to play different roles, and they have to find out who is the guardian, who is the healer in this apartment block. And
exactly.
I don't know, it just seemed like not... It's like an M. Night Shyamalan movie. I don't know how to explain it.
Where that's actually an excellent way of explaining it.
in that the it's building to something, but there's nothing's going to happen.
Mm.
So being the person who didn't see it, it sounds like, okay, people in this apartment block have to find out what role they are from this fairy tale story, a collection of fairy tale stories, but then it sounds like they don't do anything with that.
Yeah, it's true.
Do they at least have to like go on some kind of like quote unquote adventure to find out what role they are, or do they just like sit around an apartment building?
Okay, well,
in the apartment complex in Philadelphia.
So basically, the muse.
Hey, don't knock Philadelphia. That ain't the problem.
Okay, sorry. an apartment complex.
Yeah.
Hey, don't knock apartment complexes, man. Pretty stunning city. I wish they explored the city more.
So the basic plot is that this water muse nymph thing shows up, and Paul Giamatti's character finds her, and she has to help him find all of these other special people who will help her get the M. Night Shyamalan guy who's got this great destiny to fulfill his destiny, and then, I guess save the world, and then she has to escape back to her fairy tale land kind of thing. And like what you were guessing, Wayne, is totally right. They have the different roles were the symbolist, who is a person who can find and gather the rest of the team. The guild, which is a collection of people together who have no purpose as far as I can tell. The guardian, which can stave off the monsters, and the healer, who heals people.
Right.
Yeah.
That's so, it, like four or five roles, that's it, really?
The guild is seven people, but again, they're pointless. So, it's almost just to make the room look more, like there's more people and more important in it. I don't know. So, yeah. Anyway.
The guardian like stops the monster with his gaze.
Yes, he can stare it down.
Could go either way, honestly.
Well, I don't know. Like,
maybe he's such like a badass. Okay, they can stare down this monster with their gaze. Okay, that sounds pretty epic. On the other hand, it could have come across really lame, which I'm guessing it did.
Yeah. Well, that scene specifically wasn't so bad. The bad part of it is when he accidentally broke his gaze, and then the monster got away. But he was attacked by tree monkeys, and then that was the end of it. And then a giant eagle from Lord of the Rings swept down and saved everybody. Anyway, where was I? The reason that I thought that this might make a good game is that I was actually pretty inspired by the world. Like, I really like that kind of fairy tale in a mature setting, kind of style, like the remakes of Little Red Riding Hood that there's been a couple of recently. And this movie hinted at a larger mythology in the background that, I don't know, just maybe my imagination took further than M. Night Shyamalan's did. That doesn't sound egotistical. But yeah, it sounded like this kind of mythology could be put into a game that would be really interesting. And kind of, I imagine it set as a really low-powered game, where you have the different characters that were in the movie as classes, the healer, the guardian, the symbolist, etc. And maybe since this movie revolved around the nymph trying to assemble the group, you could do that as a main story, where the PCs kind of use clues to figure out who each other is or what their actual role is. Or you could do kind of a step further, where the person with the destiny is actually going out to try and fulfill their destiny after the people have found out what their special powers are. Or you could maybe have the group already fully formed, but trying to find a nymph muse thing to actually further their quest. And I think all of the monsters they presented were pretty powerful, in that they outdid the people, so it would be kind of against a superior foe, so there'd be a lot of running or escaping that I think could be a lot of fun. Or you can mix it up with, you know, different groups vying for the same destiny, or rival muses trying to get different destinies put together. But I think the main game thing that I was looking at was maybe to take the Changeling game from White Wolf and tear away the true Fae background story, because that's kind of confusing and contradictory, and then throw this mythology in instead. And I think you could make a pretty fun game out of that.
Sorry, what's the mythology?
This mythology? The blue world mythology with nymphs and scrunts and the tree monkeys and the guardian. Well,
but what's the mythology other than there's nymphs and monkeys and kind of like a dog?
Yeah, the scrunt is the dog, yeah. The mythology is that the humans are kind of the master race on the world, and that they control the fate of the world through their actions. But of course, there's lots of other creatures who live on the world, including the people in the ocean. And the people in the ocean call it the blue world. But their job is to help and guide humans in making a better world. So kind of just seeing one of these people, it's almost again like a Greek muse tale, is enough to kind of unlock a person's destiny so that they can become something greater than they might be otherwise. So I could see something again with the Changeling setting, where, you know, all of the PCs, instead of being kind of victimized by the Fae as they are in the actual Changeling setting, maybe they all just kind of share a supernatural encounter with these nymphs. And I think you could build something out of that. But
I mean, you're making a good case, but I just think it's such a garbage movie. I know we're calling this crap movies great games, but sometimes a movie just would weigh down even the best game idea. And this would be one. It sounds like, I guess I know what you're taking from it, mm-hmm. but I think you're really cherry picking.
You're totally right.
The
movie was crap.
Finding the roles that wouldn't be very fun. And they don't really seem to get any powers or do anything.
Hmm. Exactly. You'd have to throw in a lot in order to make it that. The reason I chose this one is because when it was over, I was left feeling like this. There could have been so much more to this movie than there was, but unfortunately, there wasn't.
Like, I'm gonna have to watch this to kind of figure out what you guys are saying.
Don't do it.
Like, if you're going with like the roles and people unlocking mortal people unlocking a destiny, I would tend to go maybe more with Scion, White Wolf Scion, than with Changeling. Because that's kind of the setup already. The only difference is in Scion you're getting your powers because you are the son of some kind of deity. And in this one you could just strip that away.
You've recommended that before. I actually haven't gotten around to reading that one. But
I think it was one of the games that kind of came up between Old World of Darkness and the New World of Darkness revision. Mm-hmm. So
which is that?
Scion.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I remember the game system being a little bit messy. But
so, yeah, no, but that's one I wanted to check out. Thank you for the suggestion.
Yeah, that'd be a good suggestion. And I would just suggest you play Scion, or watch like Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief.
Yeah, there's a new one out now. Well, probably
Video, it's already been out.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that movie, so that's good to hear.
Okay, no, I think I thought you made a really good case, Chris, but I still disagree.
The thing is, I kind of disagree with myself and agree with you that it's such a bad movie that it's really hard to put it into a game. But yeah,
but I like the idea of like a positive changeling, which changeling has a lot of strengths, are really good. But you know, sometimes you're like, hey, you know,
maybe don't want to play an abused victim. Damaged.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that is kind of one of the things about the game. Yeah, you are playing an abuse victim, so
yeah,
you kind of can't get around that.
Well, how about your first crap movie, Wayne?
My first crap movie is Deep Rising.
Love that movie.
I know. You know, actually, I watched it again, and I can see why you like it. I still think it's crap. It just kind of squeaks in under the wire with a Rotten Tomatoes rating of 29%. But basic premise is a band of mercenaries gets hired by a military group to go and take them somewhere. You don't know where. Turns out they're going to go hit a cruise ship. Separately, the cruise ship has been attacked by monsters and all the passengers are dead. So it kind of turns into a horror movie. There's your basic premise. Without giving away spoilers, even though who cares, because this movie is terrible. Part of the reason this movie is crap is the production values aren't terrible.
The CG's not half bad.
Yeah, it came out in 98, a couple years after Johnny Mnemonic. Better production values than Johnny Mnemonic, I thought, but still kind of poor. I don't know. The CG tentacles look kind of cheap now. It's very formulaic, I guess, which honestly might not be a bad thing, because, okay, you could just look at it and say this is a cookie-cutter movie. I looked at it and said this is a cookie-cutter movie, and that therefore it's terrible. Like, there wasn't really anything interesting going on in this movie. It was just kind of horror trope after horror adventure trope, when you're like, oh, okay, now we gotta escape the tentacles, and oh, now we gotta do the underwater scene, and oh, now this guy kind of, you know, does the double cross, and don't look behind you because there's a tentacle, and oh. Right,
somehow have to scale across a large pit of some kind, or somebody falls to their death.
Exactly.
When I saw it, though, I thought it had its genre, it had its niche, that cheesy horror film with extra cheese, but I think it really filled it quite solidly. I thought it was a pretty good example of that, but it didn't try to expand beyond that genre.
Right, and you know what, and I watched it again tonight before we recorded the episode, and it's unlike Johnny Mnemonic, this movie was not trying, you can tell it was tongue-in-cheek, you can tell it was trying to be kind of comical, and they said, yes, we know this is the trope, we're kind of going to embrace it. That doesn't make it good.
You have a very good point there.
this is still below the line of this movie is so bad we've crossed over into good territory now.
I suppose when I decide to eat McDonald's for lunch, that doesn't make it a good decision.
Exactly.
No, so actually, that's a good point. Is that some, you think that some directors or some writers, when they get together and they're like, okay, this is going to be a bad movie, but maybe if we throw in some wisecracks and wink at the camera a few times,
right,
that people say, oh, we're in on the joke, and you're like, no, yeah, I mean, it's make it comedy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
don't make this. I mean, I guess if you make Die Hard and you can throw in some jokes there, but they were trying to make a good action movie. They did make a good action movie in the case of Die Hard.
Right.
But I guess sometimes I think it gets into like lazy. It's almost, it'd be like, I'll throw in a few more explosions, but here it's like, throw in a few more wisecracks, and people like maybe buy that, you know, we get the joke. And I'm like, no, don't tell me a joke. Scare me.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't love this movie. I'm not gonna like fight you on your definition of it, but yeah, I didn't mind it. But yeah, I can certainly see why you would think it would be a great game.
Oh yeah, I guess getting to why it would make a great game, it's like all of the situations they went through on the boat, while cheesy for a movie, are something that happen regularly in role-playing games. You know, like watching this movie the second time, I could almost see the GM going, okay, and now here's the scene. What do you do?
Mm-hmm. I know what skill check and what DC this scene is going to
be. Exactly. Like I could see, like, the last scene when they're, you know, racing on a jet ski through the interior of this boat, and all the doors are shut, and he's shooting the buttons to open the door with the shotgun, I could almost see, okay, you're going to have to make a certain number. It was a skill check, right? Mm-hmm, you're going to have to make a certain number of rolls before you get get your failures, or the tentacles are going to get you.
The thing I thought would be good for a game is that when they discover Falcom Jansen, Famke Jansen, the lead actress,
Famke Jansen, yes, on the ship, yeah.
And that, I think that makes for a really good scene. It might be cliche,
right?
But they go on the ship and they find her, and it's like, well, what are we gonna do with her? Is she gonna be an ally or not an ally? So
right, and that totally is a cliche. But I thought the boat crew and the mercenaries had that as well. Like, as okay, we're enemies when we're on the boat. And you could play it where the PCs are the mercenary group or the PCs are the boat crew. And for whatever reason, you don't trust the other group. But then as soon as you get on the boat and as soon as you figure out what's happening, you know, stuff just got real. And now are you going to trust each other? And is someone going to, you know, break the deal or what's going on? So, again, I kind of saw that as being exciting to play in a game. And then when you get down to it, you're essentially doing a dungeon crawl on a boat, on this giant cruise ship, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that being a lot of fun. A lot of cheesy, wild fun.
Yeah, like again, this is something you would play not in a gritty system like World of Darkness, because then you'd be like, okay, roll this game up to 10. Oh, no, okay.
You're dead.
Yeah, you're dead. Good job. You'd have to play it in something that was kind of skewed towards player success.
Well, I think when you said Savage Worlds would be a really good choice. You know, I think this fits pulp quite well.
No, I do it in ubiquity.
Next up is my second selection. That's Battlefield Earth, which should need no introduction, but it's generally considered one of the worst movies ever made, and it has a 2% rating on the tomato meter. I'm sure there's 0%, but
really?
I'm sure there is, but...
I looked through a couple. Didn't know any of them, but...
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But this is a real big-budget disaster. Based on the book from that Scientology guy. L. Ron Hubbard.
And paid for by that other Scientology guy, John Travolta.
Yeah. And starred by that other guy, John Travolta.
Yep. Right. And this is really a hot mess of a movie. whereas, like, Johnny Mnemonic had the ambiguity of, does he realize this is a bad movie? Or is he just phoning it in? And this, I got the sense that they thought this was a good movie, you know, while they're making it. Mm-hmm. And maybe when you're making it, you're only doing your role. Like, I don't think Barry Pepper who's the lead protagonist, was trying to do a bad job, but...
Mm. Well, he's a good actor. I don't know what the deal was with this movie.
Yeah, but it's not like you take anything that he does in the movie and go, that's really bad. Yeah, it just happens to be in that movie. And, you know, he's like, well, you know, I was... and we'll just give the premise, anybody who hasn't seen it, is... The Earth was defeated by...
The Cyclos or whatever
they are. The Cyclos, like 1,000 years before.
Mm-hmm.
And
their entire military only stood up for 9 minutes against the assault.
Yeah, just like ridiculous stuff. Like, okay, we'll put it in the future by 1,000 years.
Hey, you know what? You know what? Not to interrupt, but this is sounding a lot like Numenera. So far in the future, nobody knows what's going on.
I didn't think of that connection, but holy cow.
No, I was actually going to bring that up as like...
Sorry.
Why would make a good game is because... Hey, you just throw out those BS numbers because people are like eating it up for Numenera. Yeah. Each age is what, a billion years? It's like
something
a billion
like
years
that,
in the future.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, why not? Yeah, why not a billion years? Sure, why not 9 minutes? And I think a lot of it is a lot of this, yeah, sure, why not kind of thing. But so the humans are reduced to like a pretty primitive level. And they're, some of them are working in the mines.
Mining what?
Yeah, stripping the Earth of valuable resources.
Okay,
it doesn't matter. All of them.
Oh, no,
all of them. Yeah, whatever. Throw out those numbers.
They're searching for gold.
Okay.
No rhyme or reason.
Right. So they're gold miners. There's a gold rush. Even though they have the technology to just destroy the Earth in 9 minutes, but then it's like, great, now we can mine the gold. But other humans are living outside of the bad areas, and the bad areas are where the Cyclos are. And they're primitive. They'd be like Stone Age, I think,
yeah,
or early like Bronze Age. Doesn't matter. On horses, wearing skins.
Yeah, throwing spears. Yeah.
They're safe but, because they don't have any gold, I'm guessing.
Something like that. I mean, there's only so many Cyclos, and they're set up like a mining operation, so like a, as a company that just has like kick-ass military tech. And I think they put up like a little barrier. The humans put up a barrier, so, you know, cross, of course, Barry Pepper Cross. And I guess the movie only covers about half the book. They were saving it for a sequel. But
that's what I read, yeah.
Yeah, losing massive amounts of money.
They wanted a sequel?
Yeah.
Blew up the bad guy's home planet at the end.
From what I read, it was designed as the first half of, or it was the first half of like a book. So
holy cow.
Well, I'm sure they have other
goodness,
planets.
That never happened.
And just the basic plot is Barry Pepper gets captured. For some reason, they decide to give him a bunch of information, including how to fly a jet plane. He uses that machine to teach or to sort of unlock that information and others. They have an uprising and with a few planes and a bomb and a teleporter, they defeat the Cyclos. Oh, and the Cyclos are like 10 feet tall. Sure, right. Why not?
And you give it way too much credit.
Because why not?
The entire Earth military defeated in 9 minutes, but these guys get a squad of Harrier jets and they can take out the whole mining operation.
You know right. what? Sure. Because why not?
The bomb blows up the aliens' home planet because their atmosphere is made of radiation. I'm using air quotes here.
Yes.
An explosion had never happened on the history of that planet before, and that's why they were all safe until then.
Right. You'd think they would invent a bomb that didn't quite destroy their entire atmosphere.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, and yeah, they're used to breathing in a poison gas, so they walk around with breathers that, like, I guess, pump in
poison
pollution.
Gas.
And they don't, like, they find our clean air poison. Yeah, I mean, just, yeah, it's just silly.
Hey, is that any sillier than the signs aliens coming to a planet that's, like, 90% poisonous?
That's right.
Yeah, at least they had the respirators, eh? Instead of
instead of the nothing, I'm walking around naked.
Yeah, so yeah, let's go naked on that place that rains. That's a good idea.
Humidity, no.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I'm kind of baffled as to why you think this would make a good game.
I think it would make a good game because it's primitive versus advanced antagonists. I think it could be fun to explore. I like those books and those stories. Like, was it the Horse Clans?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the future, and that you've gone down a few levels in technology, but there's still the remnants of the old civilization and the cities.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's fun.
Admitted, there were a couple of fun scenes in there when they were, after they had started to unlock the knowledge and they were trying to make plans about how to start the revolution. There's some fun stuff.
Yeah, I think that meta-knowledge would be fun for the players.
Mm.
And I was going to bring up Numenera, and it's like, Numenera, it's like the 9-minute battle, and it's 1,000 years in the future. Like, all of that stuff is just not going to matter to people if they're going to eat up Numenera's setting and think that's just, like, really great and revolutionary.
Yeah,
and then you've got guys that are very black and white. I mean, they don't, you know, they don't even breathe the same air as us. They breathe poison.
Right.
They're 10 feet tall. So each one of those guys can really play a bad guy and an antagonist.
Hmm.
They're going to be able to physically overpower you.
Except for John Travolta, yeah.
Yeah, and then they also got their own politics going on. So they might converse with you, but actually they certainly see you as like low.
Hmm.
They do see the humans as pretty primitive, so that might be something you want to tweak, where they see them as primitive, but they will converse with them. But I think in the movie, they pretty much see them as animals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could run with that, because, I mean, like it's kind of like the James Bond villain thing, right? You are so beneath me that, of course, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. Of course, I'm going to talk to you, because there's nothing you can do about it, because you are so far beneath me. So why not?
Well, you know, if we kind of look back to where our episode on animals, you know, we talked about playing as an animal in a world that, you know, you had almost no chance against a vastly superior race, that being humans. But you could kind of jump this up a step where you're playing humans, but you're up against an incredibly powerful alien race that doesn't consider you anything more than an animal. So I think you can have a lot of fun with that.
Then the only choice there is extermination, yeah.
Hmm. So you do, with a bomb on their radioactive home planet.
Yeah, I suppose, which is just as good as the virus up into the mothership. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, but it's also lots of places to hide because they do have certain areas, so there's places to escape. You can do whatever you want with that world.
I do see that. Like, That setup allows you to tell a number of different stories. Okay, is this going to be just survival and you're trying to, you know, survive in this now hostile world where there are these giant superhuman cyclos after you? Or are you going to, you know, kind of start a rebellion and try and get them off the planet? And yeah, I could see a lot of different things you could do with that setup.
Yeah, and then you can invade the, you can use their teletransporters to go to their planet.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, I know, a little bit of Stargate kind of thing. Yeah.
I know we don't play D&D, but I could see that mapping very easily to the heroic Paragon and Epic tiers of 4th edition. Heroic is you just got to survive. Paragon is now get them off your planet. Epic is now teleport over there and kick their butts.
Hmm. Obviously, that being a lot of fun, yeah.
Yep. What's your second one, Chris?
Yeah, my second one is pretty poorly rated.
I thought that was the point.
There's a but following that, though.
Oh.
Coming in at 28% on Rotten Tomatoes. But I actually don't think it's that bad of a movie. I enjoyed watching it. And that's Clash of the Titans.
You're talking about the remake.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah. I think it was very similar to Deep Rising in that it has its genre, kind of the over-the-top, epic, roar, beer and pretzel kind of movie. And I think it fills the genre very well. I don't think it goes anything beyond that. It's, I think Lyle said it really well earlier on when we talked about it in the past, that Sam Worthington is a really wooden actor who can't really do anything. The CG is nice, but, you know, it really lacks any kind of depth. The plot is pretty formulaic, epic fantasy movie, big monster, then you fight another bigger monster, followed by a even larger monster, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, again, it's not a great movie, but I didn't hate it. I thought it was fun to watch.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty joyless.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I didn't... They had some decent actors in the movie, and there was flashes where, hey, why don't we follow this guy instead of Sam Worthington?
And like, oh, be like, no, why don't we follow anybody except Sam Worthington?
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, oh, great, let's kill off everybody in this one scene except for Sam Worthington. Like, what? Really?
Mm-hmm.
Like no give and take? Like, no, yeah. Because that really brings out more Sam Worthington as nobody to act across from. Yeah.
Hey, but much like you said at the beginning, perhaps if there's only Sam Worthington, like a starving man, grabbing at a crust of bread, you'll say, you know what? He's not that bad of an actor.
You know, he's somebody. It's better than watching nothing on the screen.
Right. Is it? Is it? Really?
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely think, again, this suffers from what probably was Johnny Mnemonic's main sin, is that it gets boring. And yeah. Around about the Medusa scene, and when that finishes, you're like, oh, I'm done with this movie. And right. It didn't help that was a scene where everybody dies.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, that should have been the climax, even though it's like an hour into the movie or whatever, because I'm done with this movie.
Oh, but we still have to deal with the Kraken. Where,
yeah, when he jumps off the tower and throws the head at the Kraken, it turns to stone. I thought that was a pretty good set piece there.
But sure. I'm going to disagree. It's one of those things where, things are just too big.
Right.
And there's no suspense.
Right. And if you've lost interest by that point as well, there's not really any point in going on.
Yeah, you're like, okay, it's a giant Kraken, it's a giant CG monster, and a tiny guy is going to attack it, but you know what it's going to attack it with. There's no danger in the scene. Nothing's going to emote. It's one of those things where you're watching these type of movies, and then they decide to go on and on and on and on, and you're like, no, stop. And
you know, maybe it's kind of like a Disney movie where you know how this is going to end. It's not... There's no way this is going to not end happily for a Disney movie, right? So it's kind of like the same with Clash of the Titans. There's no way he is not going to win, right?
Yeah. No. I think the problem
is... that's a suspension of disbelief you have in a lot of movies.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know what? A good movie will make you think the protagonist might not win up until the end.
Some good movies will make you think that, but some good movies will make you not care.
Exactly. That's where it is.
Like when I watch Friday Night Lights and they're at the football game, you know, I'll be so invested in those characters that I'm like, I don't care if it's a cliche. I want them to win this game.
Well, there's the difference.
Yeah.
What character were you invested in Clash of the Titans?
Well, no, exactly. They killed them all. I mean, and I wasn't really invested in them. They were just slightly more interesting than Sam Worthington. And then there's the woman he's rescuing.
Oh, Andromeda.
And you're like, she's hardly in the movie. They try to make her a sympathetic.
Right.
Caring about poor people or something,
right.
But she's hardly in the movie, and he's in the movie a lot, but he's Sam Worthington. So you're like, well, I'm kind of rooting for the Kraken right now.
Right, you know, right.
You know, which is going to end this battle sooner, the Kraken or Perseus?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the problem. But you're right. Some movies do a really good job of making you go, well, or some TV series will making you go, well, is this person going to survive? I mean, there's definitely stakes involved, especially if you read George or George R. R. Martin or something like that. Like,
maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's a better way to say it. The stakes, okay? Like, maybe the protagonist winning is never in doubt, but what they're going to have to give up to get that win
is
you want to watch and find out, because you are invested in the stakes of this problem. Where, yeah, Clash of the Titans, I'm like, I don't really care. I don't like any of these people.
You get swept up in a movie and you just, even though the logical half of your brain might know what it's actually going to turn out to be, you just are just there to enjoy it. You shut off that overthinking part of it. You stop looking for loopholes.
Yeah, I've said this before, I can only do that to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, the movie can be really, really fun. But yeah, there's certain things it could have done. And I mean, the city could have might done more to like fight the Kraken, mm-hmm, instead of going, all right, let's just string her up.
Yeah, they could have hired somebody instead of Sam Worthington.
Yeah, and you're like, well, I don't care now about the city. If they're right. going to be like that. I mean, it's not that I really care that she's strung up, but it's like, do I really care if the city survives? Mm. I mean, the king declares war on the gods, and you're like, isn't that's kind of dumb.
Right.
Oh,
right.
It's not working out, really?
Oh, you lost? Really? Oh, at least in the original, like, it was, okay, you insulted me as offering. You were going to give me your daughter Andromeda. There was no bargaining. It was just like, this is going to happen, or I'm going to destroy the city. And then it was Perseus going, I think I can find a way around this.
Mm-hmm.
And doing it. And in that one, you actually do kind of like, you know, I don't know. I was kind of rooting for Perseus in the original.
Yeah, he's a likable guy. And he's like got that little clockwork owl. And
oh, yeah. Bubo, I think his name was. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they in this movie, they make fun of it. It's like, oh, it's just clockwork owl. And it's like, he would be the star of the show. Turn him on.
That's why they didn't use him, because we'd be like, we can't have this piece of plastic out acting Sam Worthington, because yeah, anything probably, would.
They probably filmed about a week. So, and the tennis ball they were using was out acting Sam Worthington.
That's another job.
No, that's probably what happened. They're like, they're doing it, and they're like, we have to spend all our CG budget on the Kraken, so what are we going to do? We can't CG in Bubo, that little owl, anymore.
And we can't CG Sam Worthington's facial expressions.
CG can only do so much. It can't give acting ability. So anyway, now that we've completely bagged it as it deserved, why would it make a good game?
It wouldn't make that great a game.
Did you not read the title of this episode?
There were a couple things that I liked within it that I think you could pull out and insert into another game that would make it more fun. And that's based around the way that they handled the gods in the movie. In that the gods' power is based completely off of the number and the loyalty of its worshippers. And also that the different gods can feed on different kinds of worship or different kinds of emotions from worshippers or from regular people. Now, the example from the movie is that Zeus is powered by the love of his followers. I don't think that many Greek people actually loved Zeus, but whatever, we'll pass that to the side. Then Hades was the other guy, and nobody loved Hades, so Hades had learned to live on hatred and fear. So it was kind of when Hades went down and started terrorizing everybody, he grew stronger, whereas Zeus grew weaker, because everybody was thinking that the gods were forsaking them. So I thought that could be interesting to pull into a game. I was thinking primarily in a fantasy game, because it gives a reason, not necessarily a reason for the gods to exist, but more of a reason for them to be interested and to intervene in the mortal plane, rather than just kind of being bored, as they're often portrayed. And I could see a couple interesting scenarios that you could pull out of it from this, like ganked directly from the movie, is you have, I don't know, like some kind of Al-Qaeda kind of game where the god of hatred and fear has agents running around the world blowing things up, and people are scared of that, and that in turn makes the god more powerful. So that's pretty much the only element that I thought you could pull out of this one, but I thought it might be worth looking at for putting into a game.
Yeah, that does make more sense than the usual standard fantasy reason of why should I believe that, you know, why should I believe in this god over another one, or why should I worship that god over another one, you know, where the answer is usually just because. Mm-hmm. You know, so I can see that. Yeah,
I agree. I think it'd make a good game, certainly because of the cosmology that you're talking about, Chris,
mm-hmm.
Which I think makes the game really scalable.
Because
you could be dealing with the minions, or you could be dealing with the gods themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they did declare war on the gods, which is ridiculous, but...
Isn't it though? Yeah.
Well, like we said before, the way to do that is, okay, everybody stop believing.
Well, that's the thing, though, you know.
Stop believing in the god that I'm fighting.
Well, yeah, see, like, it's not, okay, we're going to go to war on the gods and now stop believing. What, you mean these guys were fighting? No, it's, okay, we're going to go to war on the gods. Yeah. Everybody just stop believing.
If you take it to where there's emotion tied to it, that it's, so it doesn't matter if you disbelieve the gods, it's if you don't like the god or if you don't fear the god anymore, that would have an effect on the god's power.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah that makes their power wax and wane. And they would try to do things to scare people or to make them love. So you can even have the gods as like icons, like in 13th Age.
Right.
Exactly what I was thinking too. Cause,
and using something like that. No, I think that's great. I actually think just the story itself it is fine. I mean, you get together these ragtag group of people, put them on a quest. I mean, this is a myth. It's a classic story.
Right.
But it's really good, and it's worth repeating in that you're putting up the players up against one antagonist to defeat a stronger antagonist.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The cool twist, it's actually a body part of that first antagonist. And it's really cool. It's not like some sword in their treasure trove or something. It's actually their head.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I mean, that's a great element. The movie itself adds in, you know, those giant scorpions and those scorpion riders.
Right.
So certainly adds a little variety of who you can play.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good. I mean, they did have that clockwork owl, so, I mean, they didn't use it, but you could even use that as well.
Yeah, it could be fun.
No, the whole thing, it is a classic story, and it is very much, okay, we need to tackle this huge problem, but we're going to do a bunch of little steps to get there. You know, first it's, okay, we learn about the thing that can beat it by dealing with these three witches. Okay, wow, to defeat this giant problem, we have to defeat something that's, you know, only slightly less of a problem. Mm-hmm. And how do we tackle that? Okay, now that we have this thing, now we can go and defeat the Kraken, right? So it is very quest-y, which mm-hmm. I'm sure is not a mistake based on how classic or myth this is.
It fit well with a D&D kind of game where you're leveling up, so by the time you get to the point where you're ready to fight the Kraken, you know, you are high enough level that it's possible now.
You right. know, other than the... I realize that we're talking about this, but we're actually saying, hey, you know, Greek myths are great for role-playing games.
Yeah, right.
Because we're pulling out the... I mean, they did add some movie elements, like, again, the Scorpion Riders, they mm-hmm. fantasied it up. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's pretty much the Greek stories are pretty decent. So,
exactly. And no kudos to Clash of the Titans. Kudos to the Greeks.
Right.
Well done, Greeks.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That was me. Okay. Not much to it, but yeah.
And our final crap movie of the episode is?
After Earth.
Oh.
The excuse I have for watching this is it was being shown on the plane when I went back to visit my family.
Excuse not good enough.
All right. And I had heard how terrible this movie was, wanted to see how bad it was, and oh my god, it was bad. It only has an 11% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which I would have imagined it being even lower.
Hmm.
Okay, basic premise is aliens have destroyed Earth, but humanity survives on a foreign planet.
1,000 years later?
Yes. I forget how far in the future it is. No, it is whatever. It could be 1,000 years.
Is it really?
It's magic time.
It is. I'm looking at the synopsis now. 1,000 years after cataclysmic event. Yeah. Whatever. That makes it even better. Anyway, and there's a class of people who have mastered their fear and are now invisible to these predatory aliens. Will Smith and his very talented son are on a ship going somewhere, who cares where, I don't remember, transporting one of these horribly dangerous aliens for some kind of testing ceremony. Of course, something happens. They crash land on a planet. Will Smith is injured and has to guide his, again, incredibly talented son to the back half of the spaceship where the homing beacon is. And, of course, whatever monster they were transporting has broken loose. That's it.
This is, I mean, this, why this movie got 11%?
I don't know. That's like 10% more than it should have gotten.
Like, Will Smith's character is called Cypher Rage.
Yes.
Oh, and he's learned to completely suppress his fear. What? Wait, Rage? Oh. He's part of the United Ranger Corps.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's like, at least with Battlefield Earth, they seem misguided.
Right.
What were they thinking here with this after Earth?
Well, I think it was Will Smith's...
make my son famous.
Exactly. Will Smith bankrolled this thing to make his son famous. And you know what?
Because nobody else would hire him.
Probably. I don't know. If...
They actually land on Earth, eh?
Yes. Yeah. That's the big twist. Ooh, you know? The planet they've landed on is now Earth, and everything has gone feral. And there's one scene in the movie where Will Smith says to his son, is like... Because, of course, the only two survivors. He says, this whole planet has evolved to kill humans. And I'm like, well, how does that work if humans haven't been there for 1,000 years?
Yeah, exactly. It's evolved to kill something no longer there.
Exactly.
We're really hoping it will come. Except for that bird that... evolves to die on top of Will Smith's son.
Right.
And
right.
So he doesn't freeze to death. Like,
right. That was
something was quirky about its evolution.
Yeah.
I've evolved to save things that aren't here.
Right. But I don't know what they are. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And when I save it, I'll die.
Anyway. So, of course, you can guess the ending, you know. It's directed by M. Night Shyamalan. Yeah. So,
he made two...
Yeah, he made it on here. Yep.
Congratulations. Yep.
I was honestly expecting Will Smith's character to have died and for the son to be remembering the advice his father gave him. I thought that was going to be the twist. That was not, in fact, the twist. It was just, hey, my leg is injured to the point where I can't walk. I need you to go and do this, even though you're not a fully trained ranger and have absolutely no chance of making it. But you do anyway, and everybody's happy at the end, and yay, look at us. So, man, that was pretty boring.
Is the acting that bad? Because I read a review that said that Jaden Smith actually didn't do that poorly despite how bad the movie itself was. But he was just very unrefined.
You know what? He's not acting against anything besides a green screen for the majority of the movie. And I am not an actor by any means. I imagine that would be very difficult because... you have nothing to react to while you're acting.
Mm-hmm.
It shows.
Oh, I see.
It shows. He's like, you know, think of like Star Wars episodes 1, 2, and 3 when they're walking through these elaborate scenes and have no reaction on their face because the actors themselves are seeing nothing. That's what it is. He's acting against a disembodied voice in his head and a couple, you know, cut back shots to Will Smith on... essentially bedridden on the ship. So, anyway. The reason I think it would make a good game is, much like some of the other ones that we've talked about tonight, it has a very clear setup and goal. Okay, we've crash-landed on this dangerous, hostile planet that nobody really knows anything about. We shouldn't be here. What we need to get off this planet is... X miles away. Let's make it 1,000 because who cares? You guys have to go get it. I can't. And
you would keep the person stuck in the ship?
Not necessarily. It could just... part of the reason why I thought about keeping the person on the ship is because PCs always need an info dump, or the players always need an info dump, or they also kind of need like an NPC to interact with because... not all the time, but sometimes you do. And I could see it, the Will Smith character in the movie taking that role, right? I'm your guys' mentor. I am this font of information to help you, the players, when you get stuck, but I cannot go with you. You might not need it. You could totally set it up where it wasn't that way, but then... and then you could totally take it off in another direction where, okay, the players are fending for themselves. What are they going to do? Are they all going to follow the same path and go to recover this homing beacon so they can get off the planet? Or are they going to, you know, split up in little groups and go, you know, different ways? You wouldn't want to run that if the PCs did that because you don't split the party. But that is a way you could do it. Okay, players are party A. And, hey, party B went off this way because they think it's a better way. So I just kind of saw the Will Smith character as forcing the players to keep together while also being a bit of an info dump for them if they needed it.
Yeah, I can see that. I don't think you necessarily need a character to that. I mean, it's sci-fi. You could also do the same with an AI or exactly, even just like a library access computer.
Yeah, the ship.
Yeah, yeah. Still, the idea there is good, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, but it, yeah.
It also provided
a crash land on a death world.
Yeah.
Try to get off the death world.
Yeah, it could be that. I mean, it provided a little bit of motivation, I guess, because you want to save this person, and to do that, you have to go get this thing and come back.
Oh, I see. We're back to the person in the ship. Okay, yeah.
I mean, that's one way to say it. You don't have to do it that way, and you guys were coming up with good suggestions as to, you know, things you could do
without...
Well,
wouldn't they want to save
themselves? Yeah, that too.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could probably put together a lot of a fairly open style game in that case. You know, here's what's happening. There's a person dying next to you. You're going to die soon if you don't get off.
Right.
You have to survive. You have to set up a home beacon. It's your choice what you want to do, but you have to do something.
Right. So, much like my other choice of Deep Rising, this one is essentially kind of like a wilderness dungeon crawl.
You know, I think, Eka, you could probably have a lot of fun with that same kind of feeling of kind of nostalgia, or kind of pick out like, oh, I know what that is. But instead of technology, make it kind of this super future evolution of an animal, you know? It's like, oh, that's a tiger. I get it now, the stripes or something. But it's still also a monster that's trying to chase us
down. Evolved to kill humans, unlike tigers
apparently
now.
Apparently within 1,000 years, things have evolved to look completely nothing like they did before.
Oh, except for the bird that looks a lot.
Well, okay, birds look like birds, but what species of bird was that? I don't know. Who cares?
Well, I'm not a bird watcher, so it's not like I mean, you could put, unless it's a crow or a bald-headed eagle, I probably would not be able to guess. A pigeon, maybe? Yeah,
I don't know.
Okay. Ostrich. I don't know.
It's
what
a giant 1,000-year-old mutated pigeon.
Well, my bird knowledge would be like, it's not a pigeon, it's not a crow, it's not an eagle.
Dodo.
Is it a hawk? I think it's a condor.
No, because they all died of, you know, whatever.
No, I'm sorry. I think it's a condor.
Okay, whatever. You know what? Much like the Numenera setting, doesn't matter.
See, and that kind of guess and discovery could be the fun that you bring to this game.
Right. Yeah, all your bird-watching players.
Like, no, what kind of bird is it?
You show them the picture, and you're like, huh? And they're like, oh, it's a bird. Yeah. Yeah, no, like a death world can be pretty fun. Yeah, I can see that.
I mean,
it's not like you have to have Jaden Smith in this game.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. I mean, like, if you did, the fact is, based on the movie, we don't really care about the relationship between, you know, Katai Rage and Cypher Rage. Great names, by the way.
Sorry, was there a Rage and a Cypher Rage? Oh, no, Katai Rage. Oh, yeah.
Katai Rage, the kid, and Cypher Rage. Yep. Yeah.
What? He can't control his rage and his last name is Rage?
No,
he can't control his fear. Oh, okay.
Yep, can't control his fear. Yep.
He can't use rage.
I mean, why don't you just name him like Katai No Fear? I mean, might as well. Anyway, if you cared about the relationship...
Rage.
All right, whatever. Again, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. If you set it up where all of these player characters were cadets and didn't have their training yet, then it does become a little bit more interesting, you know, and it could lend itself a bit more to character advancement, you know. So that's what they tried to do in the movie, kind of, you know, this coming-of-age story, and you're not ready yet, but you have to go do it, and of course at the end he is ready and can do it. Horribly boring for the movie. I could see that being another layer of the game.
You know, if these Ursas that the aliens use to fight the humans, they're blind.
Right.
And they just smell the pheromones.
Yep.
Couldn't they just wear suits?
You would think so.
Yeah, because, you don't need a guy to suppress his fear to turn invisible, which I would imagine would be very hard to do. But you just put these guys in suits and they can't smell them, and they become like you have an army of invisible people.
Mm-hmm.
So how is this a conflict? Or you can make pheromones like that are different. Wow.
Don't know. Okay.
Perfume.
Yeah.
Everybody just wear Axe body spray. Oh, we can't see anything. Oh.
Yeah. Strangely attracted to something that I can't see.
Yeah. You found the hole in my plot. Yep.
Our whole army is douchebags.
Exactly. So, terrible movie. I think it would make a fun game.
Cool.
All right. Crap movies, good games. So hopefully all these millions of dollars that were spent into making these movies was not wasted, because perhaps you can enjoy them as a game.
Make yourself a million-dollar game. Or not. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can also follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, plus one us on G+. Join up in our forums, which is hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. That's located at idleredhands.com/forums. Or you can just send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.